south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, today's show is brought to you by caffeine. Lots of caffeine. Well, not so much, really. I just thought I'd say that to get you thinking. Because, you know, normally I hang out in places that have the best coffee in the world. And really, until I came to Latin America, I didn't know dick about coffee. In my mother's house and throughout the States, all we had was Folgers or Butternut or Hills Brothers, which we know now was barely coffee. It was just rot gut. And then came, even worse, Sanka. Remember that crap? I'll tell you, that stuff was more like toilet bowl cleaner. The only thing worse than Sanka or Hills Brothers or Folgers or those others was the coffee you'd get out of those machines in cafeterias and laundromats. Man, that stuff was foul, but what do we know? Especially when going to college and you wanted to stay alert. And for those of us who absolutely could not stand the taste of coffee, well, one of the ways to get rid of the foul taste of that coffee was to just load up on sugar and fake powdered creamer. Remember that? I think the mother brand of that plasticized stuff was Coffee Mate. Man, you know, they should plot the consumption of that crap versus the precipitous fall in American IQs. I bet there's a direct correlation. Anyway, bottom line was I didn't know what real good coffee was until I landed in Latin America years ago. And what a great education it was. I've had a house in the middle of the Guatemalan coffee fields for years. In fact, there are so many coffee plantations in Guatemala and El Salvador. You could try a cup from each different plantation every day. Then, after a year had gone by, you still would not have tried them all. Not by a long shot. There's certainly over 1,000 coffee plantations in Guatemala alone. Most of them really small plots of land, an acre or two. Though some plantations are massive. Now, as for me, I switched from maybe 6 to 8 cups a day to just 1 cup a day in the morning. Though sometimes I'll have 2 or 3 cups a day when I'm traveling, when I need a pick-me-up. You know, when you're traveling, sometimes you get weird sleeping patterns. But when I'm at home, I've been on just 1 cup of coffee a day in the morning. And I've been sticking to that pattern for about 4 years now. Why? Because about 4 years ago, when I went for a checkup at the doc, I was diagnosed with my first persistent chronic illness, high blood pressure. And I thought, hey, I'm not going to take medication for that if I don't have to. I'll try the holistic methods. You know, try to relax a little more, use breathing techniques, and get off the coffee. I'd already completely eliminated salt from my diet years and years ago. In fact, I've got a decanter of that pink Himalayan salt in my kitchen, about the size of an 8-ounce bottle. I've had that thing for about 4 years now, and it's still 3/4 full. Oh, and I don't put sugar on or add sugar to anything. I've been off sugar for more than 30 years. Though, it's funny, I end up buying a 5-pound sack of sugar at least once a year. Why? Because of my cleaning lady. When she's working, she cooks her lunch at my place. She just loves her sugar. Addicted to it, I'd say, like most Latinos and Latinas. Oh, and of course, I drink my 1 cup of coffee a day straight, black, and hard, without any additive, except a little sprinkle of cinnamon. So then, why am I mentioning this? Because if you come to Latin America and you like coffee, man, you'll be in heaven. Down here, you can buy the best coffee in the world for $5 to $10 a pound. The same stuff they sell for $30 to $50 a pound at Starbucks and other boutique coffee joints. In fact, some of the small coffee producers, the really small ones, sell their entire crop to a particular restaurant or hotel chain. I know a German coffee producer in Lake Atitlan. I'd say he's got about 10 acres of coffee. He sells almost every bit of it to a German hotel chain. Though he has sold me a few pounds here and there when he's got a bumper crop. And he's got a little coffee shop / lunch counter right in front of his finca. Finca's a farm. Where, of course, if you order a cup of coffee, it's going to be from his farm. And that's what it's like down here amongst the coffee producers. If they're quite small, they either keep the crop for themselves and their families. And if it's really top-notch, they'll sell the whole crop to a boutique coffee outfit. Always located, of course, somewhere in the first world. And the big outfits will sell their crops to businesses like Starbucks. Oh, and there's coffee co-ops all over too. What the hell's a coffee co-op? So let's say you want to start a coffee plantation and you don't have a particular buyer on the line. You could sell it to a co-op. It's a place anyone could bring their coffee to and they buy it. Then mix it with a lot of other small producers, but they don't get much money for it. They'll buy it from you for a buck or two or three a pound, which really isn't fair value, but at least the sellers know they're going to get something for it. By the way, at my most recent Expat Insider Seminar, which finished off about a week ago now, one of our expat buddies and repeat offender, Kelsey, came to the seminar bearing gifts. He brought along a bag of coffee for everyone attending the seminar. Nice guy that he is. Coffee he'd harvested from his own small farm. Kelsey's one of those expats who's a doer, not a talker. He sees opportunity all over the place. One of those guys who came down to one of my very early seminars and decided he liked it so much he was going to invest down here. So he moved down part-time, and one of his investments was a little coffee farm. And I have to say, his coffee is pretty damn good. So then you might ask, why did he pick coffee, and what did he know about coffee? Well, how about absolutely nothing? Zero, nada. But you see, that doesn't stop a persistent gringo from going after something. Now, you might wonder, how did that idea even form in his mind to get a coffee plantation? That's weird, right? Well, he also started a cement business, but that's a subject for another rant. Anyway, as it turns out, our seminar lawyer, Jose, has had a small coffee plantation for 10 or 15 years now. And our own Captain Mango, who moved down here to Guatemala by way of Cleveland, happens to have a green thumb and was in the family business, a plant and horticulture business back in Cleveland. So it was a natural transition. He's been managing that coffee farm of Jose's for some years now, too. If you ever come down, if you were to visit that place, you'd see he lives in a nice little house that was built specially for him right on the premises. Wait a minute. I know what some of you are thinking. Well, trust me. Rest assured, Captain Mango's horticulture business back in the States, back in Cleveland, was completely legal. Though we're taking his word on that. By the way, in some past seminars, lawyer Jose has gifted bags of coffee from his farm to our seminar attendees as well. The moral of that story is, if you're into coffee, Latin America is the place to be. Of course, you could end up drinking way too much of the stuff. Funny thing, too, when you do run into people who are addicted, they'll tell you about all the research and pointing to all the positive and great things coffee does to your body and system. They'll go on and on about the antioxidant and phytochemical effects, etc., etc. The problem is, there are just as many studies out there saying coffee's not so good for you at all. So, who's right? Who do you believe? I don't know. Just saying. All right, moving on. An email from Greg. He says, Johnny, I'm new to the kind of construction they do in Latin America. Cement, block, concrete, rebar, etc. So, I don't know what to use to hang pictures and curtains and heavy things on these type of walls. Some people say, just hammer concrete nails and you'll be all right. Some people say, drill holes and use screws. What about a nail gun that uses 25 caliber blanks? Thanks, Johnny. Looking forward to hearing your responses. Signed, Greg. Well, thanks for that, Greg. Very good question. I wish someone would have discussed that kind of stuff with me when I first got done. I made lots of mistakes with walls. One was using those 25 caliber bullet nails. You know, a Hilti gun, they're called. Not recommended. And man, after building a bunch of houses down here and fastening countless things on cement and plaster walls, even on crappy drywall, all I can say is you've come to the right place, man. You got something to hang on a wall, just ask me. I'll tell you how to put it there permanently. When I hang or stick something on a wall, it lasts a lifetime, two lifetimes. But there is such a thing as overkill. I have been accused of that, you know, more than once. Anyway, what you use to fasten things on walls down here depends whether you're renting or buying. Because here's the thing, if you're renting and you start hanging pictures and mirrors and stuff, technically that's all right. You should be allowed to do that. I mean, hell, you gotta have pictures and mirrors, correct? Problem is, when you pack up and leave the place, if you don't fill those holes and disguise them nicely, the landlord will heavily discount the return of your deposit. Man, that's happened to me, and you can't win because he's holding your money. What I mean by that is they might just charge you for an entire brand new paint job. And I'll tell you, that's happened to me twice in my years down here. Two different times, a real dickhead of a landlord discounted me hundreds of dollars for a brand new paint job just because he didn't think the holes that I spackled over adequately matched the texture of the adjacent walls, which had their own cracks and furrows in them, etc., etc. That was one of those days I was so glad I didn't have a gun in my glove compartment. By the way, I later realized that those two horrible landlords that gouged me when I left, just because of those holes, which, by the way, I did spackle over nicely. The only thing was, I didn't have any of the original paint to match. Actually, I had a can that I found under the sink, but wouldn't you know it, details. When I opened the can, there was paint in there, all right, but it was a solid, rock-hard mess because the last fool who put it there didn't close the lid properly. Like I said, details. By the way, if you can't find the paint that matches, or you have a can of paint, but it's rock hard, good luck trying to find a match in the paint department at the local hardware store when the paint job in the house is 4 or 5 years old. By the way, if you want the remaining paint in a can to last for years and years, here's a trick. Put some of that clear plastic wrap, like Saran wrap, over the top. Put the lid on. Make sure it's tapped down nice and tight. Then turn the can upside down and store it on the shelf. I said upside down, yeah? Sounds counterintuitive. Your paint will be fresh even years later. But as far as the easiest, fastest, and best way to hang things permanently on walls, down here in Latin America, let's talk about drywall first. And you know I hate drywall. I would never use it myself. But many times, especially if you move into a new place or a newer place, you will find sections of drywall. It's especially fashionable these days for people to put in drywall drop ceilings so they could put some hidden indirect lighting. I have to say, it does look pretty cool, but again, it is drywall. And Latinos have not yet figured out after 500 years how to handle leaky roofs. And as you probably know, a little leak will destroy a piece of drywall in a hurry. It'll never be the same. The only way to bring it back to snuff is to cut out that bad section and replace it with a new piece, which is not a job unless it's a very small section that even a good do-it-yourselfer can handle. Replacing and matching drywall and mudding it and getting the seams right and dead flat and level takes a lot of practice. And man, I'll tell you, I've seen some shit drywall jobs in my day, even in new houses done by so-called professionals. Here's what I found. 90% of the time when you have to fix some drywall down here in Latin America, it's because there was a water leak. That means the very first thing you have to do is check out the roof, windows, or doors and suss out where it's seeping in. Make sure that leak's 100% fixed or it's just going to happen again and ruin your repair job. Oh, and did I tell you working with drywall is always one of the dirtiest jobs you could do? Dust and gypsum powder everywhere on your clothes, your dressers, hair, nose, shoes, lamps, drapes, everything. All because there's so much sanding and prepping before you can paint it. Anyway, I found the number one fastener to use with any drywall when you're hanging a picture or whatever. They're called toggle bolt wing nuts. You can get them on Amazon. They come in 3 different sizes. With those things, you can hang the heaviest pictures and frames and mirrors. And believe me, they will not work loose. My advice, get an assorted box from Amazon and have them around the house. Remember, this is just for hanging things on drywall, not for cement or block. Now, I don't want to get any emails from you guys telling me about other kinds of fasteners for drywall because I've tried them all. Sure, all the other ones work for a while, but they all eventually will fail except the toggle wing nut type I'm talking about. For one thing, they're all metal, no plastic at all. So then how strong are those things? Well, I've hung 50-pound mirrors and window frames with just one of the bigger ones. Remember, like I said, there's 3 sizes. All right, let's talk about fastening things onto brick and cement walls. Well, there's something I learned a long time ago if you're just hanging a small and light picture frame, for example. Now, of course, you're going to need a power drill. Hopefully, it's got a percussion drill setting. You know, some drills have a setting for regular screws and wood and sheet metal. And decent drills will almost always have a percussion or hammer drill setting. It vibrates the drill bit while it's spinning, so it penetrates faster. Do buy a decent drill and a set of assorted concrete drill bits. You won't regret it. A basic home-use drill and a set of bits probably will set you back $35 to $50. You know, for the average guy, he might only use that drill twice a year, so it's okay to get a cheap one. Unless you're into do-it-yourself projects, then you'll want to spend $50 or $100 and get a commercial or heavy-duty model. then it will sustain a lot of dings and bangs and drops on the floor. For example, I have a couple of really expensive commercial drills. One, a Makita I dropped from a three-story building. Oops. I thought, there's $100 down the drain. So I walked down the stairs with a sad face, cursing myself out. I picked it up. It had a big gouge in it, but hey, it still worked. Remember that old commercial? Takes a licking, keeps on ticking. If you're a boomer, you remember that was a Timex watch commercial. Anyway, here's a quick and dirty, fantastic solution if you're hanging something light, maybe 25 pounds or less, on a black brick or concrete wall. Yeah, take your drill in an eighth inch or 3/16 or even a quarter inch concrete bit. Mark the spot where you want to drill your hole. Start drilling that hole, and when you're in just about a quarter inch, not much, angle your drill down about 20 degrees and proceed to drill into that wall about an inch and a half deep at that 20 degree angle. By the way, when I'm doing that myself, I always take a piece of masking tape and tape it onto the drill bit at the 1.5 inch mark so I can see what's happening all the time and I know how deep I'm going. When you're done drilling that hole, take a plastic straw, you know, regular plastic straw, or a paper one if you're a greenie or a tree hugger. You have paper straws around the house, right? I know you're doing your part like me to save the planet. Anyway, you put one end of the straw over the hole, you blow into it, yeah, with your lips, and all the dust and powder packed in that hole will fly into your face. But that's okay because you're wearing protective glasses, right? And one of those useless leftover N95 COVIDiot masks. You must still have a couple dozen of those useless pieces of shit stuffed into your junk drawer now, don't you? By the way, you should always, anytime you drill a hole in a concrete wall, use that straw method to blow out any residual powder that might be in that hole. Especially if you're going to do what we're going to talk about later, that is, fill the hole with an adhesive like liquid nails. Because, you know, there will be times you want to hang something really heavy on your concrete, cinder block, or brick wall. Oh, just a warning here, if you do use liquid nails and permanently place an anchor into a wall, it better be in a house that you actually own, because if you're renting, you might have a dickhead landlord who will screw you out of your deposit or tell you to take him out and spackle him over, and that might not go well. And if you do that, chances are he'll still screw you out of your deposit. Anyway, once you've got that 1.5 inch hole drilled at a 20 degree angle and cleaned out, blown out with a straw, or maybe you have an air compressor if you're a serious or even fanatical do-it-yourselfer like me, then you certainly won't need a straw. While we're at it, here's another way to reduce the mess. You take your shop vac. I assume all you guys and gals out there have a shop vac. I really recommend it if you live in Latin America, even if you're not a do-it-yourselfer, because it sucks up water. A shop vac is a wet-dry vac. And I have to say, at least 10 times in my life, in the last 30 years or so, I had to use my shop vac to suck water from someplace inside my house, either after a heavy rain or a broken water pipe or overflowing shower, sink, or toilet. It will absolutely come in handy. Highly recommended wet-dry vac. Anyway, any and every time I drill a hole in a concrete wall, even just to hang a picture frame, I'll put the suction tip of the shop vac right under the drill bit as it's spinning. Sucks up all the powder and the dust. Never even hits the floor. There's no cloudy dust in the air either. Anyway, once you've drilled that hole for your picture frame or whatever, you take a 2-inch common nail or a finishing nail, shove it in that hole and you're done. Sure, it seems loose and you can wiggle it around, but gravity is your best friend here. Now you can hang your picture or mirror on the little nail head that's sticking out about a quarter inch from the wall. There's no way that picture is going to fall unless you have a catastrophic earthquake or your picture frame or mirror is flimsy as shit. Another reason I really like that method is if you move from the place, let's say you're renting, there's just a tiny little hole that you could spackle up in a second. All right, so that's for hanging pictures and mirrors and stuff. But what about when you're fastening something to a cement wall, like kitchen cabinet, something really heavy? Something you want to fasten permanently or almost permanently, like a shelving unit or even a sink. In that case, you'll use plastic or wood anchors. They're called tarugos down here. When you go to the hardware store, ask for tarugos, T-A-R-U-G-O-S. Now, as for me, I never buy the fancy ones, just the plastic ones that are almost solid. They kind of look through a cross-section like a star. And I've often used the wooden ones as furniture plugs. When you drill a hole through a piece of wood, you want to fill it, then sand it and varnish it, make it look real nice. Otherwise known as furniture dowels up in the States. Though 90% of the time, I use the plastic ones. They're great if you only plan on mounting something once. In other words, you don't take the screws in and out and in and out. You want to go with the wooden tarugos if you're going to take something on and off or mount and remount. Because though the plastic ones are very strong and solid, they'll eventually get stripped out inside. You know how plastic is. It's flexible. Wood, not so much. Anyway, assuming you're going to mount, let's say, a kitchen cabinet permanently, you're going to stick with the plastic. By the way, if you want to know exactly what these things look like, the kind I always get, they're in almost every Latin American hardware store. And they're cheap, a couple of cents a piece. Send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll send you a photo. Anyway, here's the trick, and it's kind of my trick. I don't see anyone else doing it. But then again, almost everyone who does not use the little trick I'm going to tell you about right now finds their tarugos, their wall plugs or fasteners, eventually get loose and fall out. And that's not good, especially if you're hanging a cabinet or a shelf. By the way, your plastic tarugos are all color-coded. I always buy the longest ones. They're usually 2 or 3 inches long. And I take a heavy-duty snippers or tin snips and cut them to the size I want or need as I'm using them. And though they're dirt cheap, if you buy the long ones, you save even more money because you'll cut them in 2 or maybe 3. That means you might be able to use 1 2- or 3-inch tarugo in 2 or 3 different holes that you've drilled. Depends how many pieces you cut it in, right? As mentioned, these things are color-coded. I think the green ones are 1/4-inch diameter and the blue ones 3/8 inch diameter. Now, if I'm hanging a cabinet or a big shelf, I want to drill my anchor holes at least 1.5 inches deep. 2 inches is better. All right, so let's say I'm drilling 2 inches deep. I take my blue tarugo, 3/8 inch in diameter. I take a 3/8 inch drill bit, drill that 2-inch hole, blow out the dust and the dirt with my straw, cut the tarugo slightly short of 2 inches. Let's say 1.75 inches. You could shove it in the hole right now, and it probably will stay there. It'll support your shelf or cabinet, whatever you're fastening to the wall. The problem is whatever screws you're screwing into that tarugo are gripping that thing and being held there only by expanding the plastic tarugo against the concrete hole it's being held in. Good enough for now, but in the future, after so many openings and closings of those cabinet doors and maybe slamming them quite a few times, that kind of vibration over time will loosen those tarugos. Have you ever seen an old cabinet or shelf that's starting to pull away from the wall? I bet you have. When that happens, it's not an easy job to fix it. If you want to eliminate that possibility completely, here's what you do. After you've drilled the hole and blown out the dust and crap inside with your straw, get your caulk gun. You'll have one of those around the house, right? They're only $2 or $3. Pop in a tube of liquid nails. Have you heard of that stuff? Well, there's all kinds of competitors, so just buy the cheapest one. Normal size for a caulk gun will probably run you $3 or $4. Now, a tube that size in a caulk gun will last a do-it-yourselfer through many projects. Anyway, you jam the nozzle of the liquid nails into the hole or holes that you've drilled. Don't load it up too much. Just inject enough, about as much as the first joint on your little finger. Shove in that 1.75-inch tarugo, tap it home and flush to the wall with your hammer, and you will notice some of the liquid nails oozing out right at that point. Could get kind of messy. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, you should put some masking tape over the tip of your hammer head, because it's going to get a coating of liquid nails too, and later you can just peel off the masking tape and your hammer will look fresh and new. And now you're done for a while. Leave the project alone for at least 4 hours. As for me, I always like to wait a whole day. When I'm back on the project the next day, those tarugos are part of the wall for keeps. You'll never get them out of the wall unless you blast or drill them out. In either event, it ain't easy. Anyway, next day is when I mount the shelves or cabinets. Oh, and sometimes when you tap a tarugo into the wall, you may have made a miscalculation in the depth of the hole and it won't go in all the way. Maybe it's 3/4 or 7/8 way in. Not to worry, though, not to panic. Just leave it, and the next day, when the liquid nails has set, take a chisel or a big flathead screwdriver, grab your hammer and chip away at the excess plastic that's sticking out of the wall. Flush it up with the wall. Doesn't have to look pretty because the cabinet or shelf's going right over it. So anyway, Greg, there you have it. Everything you wanted to know about fastening anything onto a cement or concrete wall here in Latin America. Oh, it's true, there are other ways and dozens of different fasteners, but take it from me, I'm an expert on hanging things and punching holes in walls. That reminds me, I remember one time visiting my brother's house way back when, before I left for Latin America. I walked into his house. It was all drywall. That's the standard construction technique up in the States, which, as you know, is all right up in the States and perfectly adequate as long as your roof doesn't leak. But as you certainly know, drywall is pretty flimsy. Anyway, I walked into my brother's kitchen and I saw there were at least 10 holes in his drywall. Fist-sized holes. A couple of holes in all four walls. I said, "What happened? Did you do that?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Those are your fist marks? Why?" He said, "Because they look better on the drywall than they would on the wife." Now, just one thing about my brother. He's the nicest guy in the world. He's got a million friends, but he has a terrible temper. Though he never hit a woman, ever. There are lots of guys in Chicago who wish they'd have never pissed him off. In fact, he's sort of a shining knight, a defender of women. In fact, I remember two specific times in Chicago bars where my brother saw a guy verbally or physically abusing a woman. I saw him deck two guys that way, and he didn't even know the girl or the guy. Just one of those chivalrous guys that doesn't like to see guys giving women shit. Hey, how about one more amusing story about my brother? His high school girlfriend told me this years after she broke up with him. She said they were at a movie one night. It's about 1 a.m. when they got out. They're driving around North Chicago, come to a red light. There's no one around. Just one guy behind them with a souped-up car, revving his motor. They're at a red light. It turns green. My brother must have been kissing his girlfriend or something. He didn't take off right away. The guy behind him laid on the horn. Impatient he was. They proceeded to the next light. It turns green. My brother, again, is a little slow on the gas pedal. The guy behind him lays on the horn again. Next intersection, my brother makes sure he ends up there during a red light. It turns green. He doesn't go. The guy lays on the horn again. But my brother doesn't move. The other guy beeps and flashes his lights. My brother stays put. The guy gets out of his car, all pissed off, goes over to my brother's window, beats on the window, says, "What's wrong with you? Get moving, asshole." The guy gets back in his car, floors it, whips around my brother's car. He's in front now. At the next intersection, the guy's in front of my brother. He makes sure he stops there when the light's green. My brother gets out of his car, walks over to the guy, beats with his fists on the guy's windshield so hard he breaks it, shatters it. Then he ripped off the guy's side view mirror with his bare hands, went to the other side, ripped that one off, threw both of them on the guy's hood, got back into his car with his girlfriend and swooped around the guy, then calmly drove away. And apparently the other guy was so shocked, he didn't bother to follow him. Yep, my brother was fearless. In another life, he'd have been a great knight saving damsels in distress. As for me, I'm sort of short on gallantry.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.